will be pronounced, who is from the College of Urban Planning and Architecture here at the University of Washington. He'll be presenting the evaluation of peak pricing on single-family residential water consumption in Seattle. And also, I want to remind you, after this, we will have a lunch break, and please come back at 1:25. We have a whole lot of exciting speakers lined up for the afternoon. So thank you, and here is David.
Thank you very much for listening today. My name is David Hsu. I'm a graduate student here at the University of Washington, and the topic of my talk is an evaluation of peak pricing on single-family residential water consumption in Seattle. So just by way of motivation for this talk, urban water supply specifically is a growing concern worldwide. I won't elaborate too much on climate change because there's so many talks on climate change here today. But two other major trends that are really driving concerns about urban water supply are continued urbanization and economic development. Continued urbanization, the United Nations estimates that about 50% of all of humanity actually now lives in cities or urban areas. Within a decade, that's expected to go to 60%. And economic development. Until very recently, the whole world was getting richer. That's not the case anymore. But because of economic development, as people get richer, they consume more natural resources, and water is no exception. So there's a lot of reasons, or very large-scale trends, or reasons to manage urban supply, demand, and water infrastructure. And again, you know, we have a fixed, in the case of Seattle and several other large cities, we have a fixed water supply from a protected watershed. We have really no compelling substitutes for industry, agriculture, food, washing, and we have a lot of these competing uses. So here's a trend I just want to start off with, again, a kind of macro trend in Seattle. This is probably not a surprise to anyone in the room, largely because it's probably through the efforts of a lot of people in this room. But you know, I'm always surprised, actually, when I go outside of a group of people who are interested in water, they're actually surprised that water consumption has gone down relatively in Seattle. And so if you look at this graph, the red line at the top, is the population in the city of Seattle's service territory for the past 30 years. And if you look at that line, it's going straight up. The service territory has gone from about 1 million people to 1.4 million people. So that's an increase of about 40% in population. But if you look at the total consumption and the billed consumption, which are the blue lines and green lines respectively, those have stayed relatively flat and even gone down slightly. Now, the difference between total consumption and billed consumption, just to briefly explain this, is that the total consumption includes all the system uses, includes all the water that leaks out of the system, includes all the water that we use to flush the system. And so if you look at the blue and green lines, they've gotten closer together over the last 30 years because we've done a lot to stop leaks, and we flush Green Lake less often than we used to. But if you look at even billed consumption has stayed relatively flat and gone down slightly. But because of the population growth in the service territory, on a per capita basis, total consumption has gone down by 35%, and billed consumption has gone down by 25%. So this trend is also occurring. This is the part that may be a surprise to some of you. This trend is occurring in other large major cities, mostly the dense cities, Boston, New York, and Los Angeles also. And so what I really want to get at in kind of studying this particular topic of single-family residential water consumption is why is this happening and how long is it going to happen for? So just to briefly review, there's a lot of hypotheses for why water consumption may be going down. And just, you know, by way of kind of a review, various disciplines really tend to focus on the different policy options that are specific to their expertise. If you look at, you know, a lot of engineering literature, engineers tend to focus on stuff. They tend to focus on low-flow shower heads, low-flow toilets. Urban planners like myself tend to focus on urban form, urban density, and building codes. There's a really interesting literature in psychology and sociology talking about how behavior and attitudes actually influence levels of water consumption and also energy consumption. And finally, economists, it should be no surprise, focus on pricing policies. So they focus on prices and quantities. So in this talk, or my research, I really decided to focus on price for a number of reasons. First, you know, pricing policies are very cheap to deliver. We send out bi-monthly bills already, and we can simply change the price, and everyone gets that signal every 2 months. But not only can we change the price and send that signal, we can actually target specific users. We have different rate classes for different kinds of buildings, but we can also target specific users based on certain consumption classes. If you consume more beyond what might be a reasonable amount, we can also charge you more. And you can use these different rate classes and consumption classes to signal the environmental cost of supply. And I think the last point I want to make on this slide is the fourth bullet there, is I think really kind of underappreciated. You know, even though all these different disciplines have different conservation policies and really kind of different emphasis, I think good rate design is really fundamental for any of these policies to work. So the research question in this talk I'm really trying to focus on is, what is the impact of a new price structure in Seattle that was imposed in 2001? Before 2001, we had a two-tier inclined block price rate structure, which really meant that there are two different prices for water. And then in 2001, what happened is Seattle Public Utilities put in place a third tier. It's kind of colloquially referred to as the shock rate. It was designed to apply to summer peak consumption. And what happened is, you know, if you open up your water bill and you use what's considered to be beyond an unconscionable amount of water, then you hopefully would get a shock and have an incentive to reduce your consumption. And so that threshold for a very large amount of water was 18 CCF per month. That's about 13,000 gallons per month. That's a lot of water. The vast majority of people don't use that much. And what I really want to emphasize in my analysis, my results, is that is a nonlinear price structure. So it actually, the price you get charged depends on the quantity you consume. So that requires a special kind of analysis. And the graph at the bottom really just summarizes what I've been saying. The left-hand two yellow and orange blocks indicate that before 2001, if you used up to 5 CCF on the x-axis, they would charge you about $2.88 per unit. After 5 CCF, they would charge about $3.35 per unit, so it's a very nominal increase. But beyond 18 CCF, you get to that red block, which is when your price would suddenly go up by a factor of 2.5. And that, the red block, is what was new in 2001. So just to understand why these tiers are so important, if you actually plot out the total distribution of consumption within each tier, you actually get a very interesting result. If you look at the graph on the left-hand side, you can see the number of customers in each tier. The bars represent the number of customers in each year. So the blue bars at the bottom represent the first tier of water. These are the people using less than 5 CCF per month. If you look at the white space or the beige space in the middle, that's really kind of your middle class of water consumption. That's where most people really consume just a little bit into the second tier. But if you look at the red bars at the top, you realize that maybe 5 or 10% of your users are using a relatively large amount of water. Those are the red bars at the top on the left. And the reason why you can see they're using a lot of water is on the right-hand side. That's actually, the right-hand bars represent the percentage of consumption or the percentage quantity of consumption by tier. So again, the blue bars represent your lowest water users, and even though they represent about 20 to 40% over the years of your water consumers, they're only consuming less than 20% of your total water consumption. Again, there's this kind of broad middle class and beige on the right. But again, your top consumers, the right red bars on the right-hand side, this 5 to 10% of your customers are really using 25 to 30% of your water. So the modeling approach we need to take really has to reflect these nonlinear prices to understand why you end up in each tier. I use what's called a discrete continuous choice model to model the effect of these nonlinear prices and also to control for weather and physical characteristics. And the steps of the model are really, first you start with a discrete choice model, which calculates the probability of ending up in each tier. And that allows you to estimate the effect of different prices on tier choice. The second step is called the continuous choice model. And that's basically just simply a linear regression within each tier. But the important point about that is that you calculate the effect of the appropriate marginal price in each tier. If you're in the second tier and you're trying to decide whether or not to consume another CCF of water, you don't really care what the price is in the first tier or the third tier. You care what the marginal price is in your tier. And finally, once you've done this discrete choice model and this continuous choice model, you can use this model to simulate the results statistically and calculate the effect of changing prices or other variables. So the data I'm working with is from Seattle Public Utilities. It's from their billing database. It's a panel data structure, which means that it's repeated observations on the same households. It's only for single-family residential households, and these are basically the bi-monthly bills that all of you get if you live in a house. And because this database is very large, I took a random sample simply for 8 census tracts. So again, the model I'm working with is a discrete continuous choice model. The outcome variable I'm trying to predict is household water consumption on a bi-monthly basis, and the predictors for that outcome our average temperature and total precipitation, again using the SeaTac data that Eric mentioned, a marginal price history from Seattle Public Utilities, and then lot size and house value are from the King County Tax Assessor database. And you know, intuitively it makes sense. The size of your house and the actually house value is a great proxy for income. So basically either your income or the value of your house also affects how much water you use. Finally, as Dennis mentioned in a previous talk, we had severe droughts in 1992 and 2001. So I removed that data because the voluntary and mandatory drought restrictions are likely to have bias with the results. So just to show you what it really means to work with this kind of individual household data, this is a particular house, a household in Sandpoint. This is the time series of their water consumption. And as you can see, that it's very, very seasonal, actually. You can see the valleys there. The valleys there are fairly flat, and you can see the summers there bounce all around. So it's a very peaky or very seasonally determined time series. So the policies I'm trying to look at is basically the imposition of the three-tier price policy, which are indicated by the green bars on the right. The two-tier price policy is only applied to the summers on the left, and as I said, I removed 1992 and 2001. So because we're focused only on the summers, we look at just the data points that fall into each of these bars. And then before 2001, we had two tiers. And after 2001, we had three tiers. So you can see that this person, this particular household, is actually a very high water user. The vast majority of people are down here around 0.1 or 0.2 CCF per day. This person is using much more than that in the winter and much, much more than that in the summer. So this pricing policy is really designed to really target this specific person or this class of users. So the results I have. First, when you estimate the discrete choice model, I estimated the coefficients for an ordered categorical fit. I applied the center normalized data so we could compare the results. If you look at the variables on the right, there's temperature, price, the log of house value, the log of lot size, and precipitation. And if you compare the estimates, because they're all in terms of standard deviations, you can see the relative impact of all these different variables. The estimate for temperature makes sense. It's 0.42, and it seems to have the highest impact on which tier you end up in. It is statistically significant, but it's also important just to recognize that temperature is probably the most important determinant, more than the price, more than house value. But I've highlighted price here in red because actually price also, the sign makes sense. Statistically significant, as price goes up, the quantity of water you consume goes down. So it has the right sign. And you know, very, very close in magnitude to the price are the house value and the lot size. As your house value goes up, which is a proxy for getting richer, you probably consume more water. As the size of your house goes up, you also probably consume more water. A surprising result here for some of you might be that the precipitation actually seems to have very little impact. It's relatively small. 0.09 compared to house value, price, and temperature. The R-squared equivalent for this model is 36%. These are just preliminary results, but it's not bad for social science data. So I guess just to summarize the conclusions from these results, the choice probability of landing in the third tier is influenced first by temperature, then by price, and then your physical housing characteristics. And precipitation is relatively unimportant. Now, if you've landed in the third tier, actually, the interesting thing is that these results are completely reversed. If you look at the results here, I've ordered them again in increasing size or decreasing size. The log of lot size has the biggest estimate for how much water you consume. So I guess the take-home message between the discrete choice and the continuous choice model is that a bunch of factors dictate whether or not you're likely to end up in the third tier. Temperature first, then price, and then house size. But if you're in the third tier, and you're in the third tier to start with, the biggest determinant of how much water you consume is the size of your house. So the R-squared equivalent of this fit is 35%. And again, housing, once you're in tier three, housing best explains the quantity of water that you use. And I really want to emphasize these results just to kind of explain. I'll circle back to this in a second to explain the graph and the distribution of consumption and the tiers. But what you want to do is develop a model like this so you can calculate useful quantities like the elasticity of water demand. The elasticity of water demand measures the effect of price on consumption. It's a simple percentage change ratio, the percentage change in quantity over the percentage change in price. And you really want to use, or rather, I use ratios like this to understand questions like this, which is, how does the quantity decrease with the increased price for an average user? The first answer is if we change our third tier price by about $1, the change in the probability of landing in the third tier goes down by about 8%, and the change in quantity in the third tier goes down by about 5%. If you were to change the third tier price by 250%, which is what Seattle Public Utilities did in 2001, the change in probability of landing in the third tier is 26%, and the change in quantity in the third tier went down by about 14%. And I mentioned these two categories of results to explain this graph, which we focused on before. You know, your first instinct might have been if you increased the price up here by 250%, you might think that everyone might actually exit that tier completely. But actually what you see is you see a steady decline, and you see the fact that, you know, even today, there's a non-zero number of people up here in the third tier. So even though you see a steady trend downward in the number of consumers and a steady trend in the quantities consumed by tier, these actually may not have the same percentage at all. You might have people still left in this tier for a variety of reasons. And then you might have people in this tier still consuming about 20% of your water, largely probably because they have fairly large houses. So just to summarize, the preliminary conclusions are that I've applied a discrete continuous choice model to water demand. It's a fairly theoretically, I think, sensible model in terms of economics and statistics. And based on that model, the price reduced the number of people in the third tier by 26%, and the price reduced the quantity consumed in the third tier by about 14%. I have a lot of ongoing research, but there's a few questions I'm still trying to answer, which is first, I'd like to establish causal inference. One caveat to this model is that I've basically lumped in all the changes in water consumption as a result of price. There's obviously a lot of conservation efforts going on throughout the region and also in different disciplines. I want to make sure that we can prove that if there's been a drop in water consumption, we can properly attribute it to price. And I think actually I have a few approaches to that that will be pretty interesting. Second, I want to investigate seasonal and geographic variation. We've seen in a number of talks that there's a lot of seasonal variation, not only in water supply, but also water demand. And it may not surprise you to find out that actually water demand varies geographically throughout the city quite a bit. There may be neighborhood or group level effects that affect water demand that I actually haven't captured in my individual level data. And finally, if I can establish causal inference for pricing policies and investigate seasonal and geographic variation, I'd like to identify the effects of other conservation policies as well. Thank you very much. I think we have about 5 minutes for questions. And if you have any questions for me directly, you can also email me at u.washington.edu. Thank you. Yes.
What percentage of overall water use is used by these single-family homes throughout the city?
Okay. Well, the question was, what percentage of total water use is represented by single-family homes in the city? Actually, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure Seattle Public Utilities has it in their draft water plans. You can look at that on the web there. A question back there in the blue shirt.
Yeah. I want to point out a communication disconnect. You talked about, in your slides, lot size, and when you were speaking orally, you talked about house size. And I want to make sure you're talking about lot size as in square footage of lot rather than square footage of house, because yeah. I think they're very different when you're looking at analyzing lot use.
Yeah, so I actually use the square footage of lot size. The reason why I did that is because, again, a lot of the summer changes in water use is expected. I think what you're getting at is that a lot of the expected change in water use is expected to be outdoor water use. And so I did use lot size. Okay. I have a sort of question back there in the black shirt.
I'm wondering about your, just a little bit of clarification about the red graph. That is intended to be the upper class or the highest income bracket.
Okay, and a really interesting analogy for these results is basically taxation. And we have a progressive taxation system. The more you earn, you go into a higher tax bracket. So these actually are not income-derived brackets. These tiers that you fall in are purely the result of how much water you consume. So even though the results show that you're likely to be in the third tier because your house is fairly valuable, you're only charged basically based on how much water you use. So it's, I hope that it didn't make any confusion there.
Okay, so those tiers are, the red is targeted at the...
Yeah, so that's right. So so people in this tier are only in that tier because they consume that much water. A question here?
Maybe a stupid question, but it makes me curious. If you went around and asked any water users if they know how much they're paying for water, if they're even cognizant that there's a free tier with a third tier that is 150% more?
Right. The question was, do prices matter? I guess, you know, my personal feeling is that I do believe prices matter. There's actually interesting literature. A lot of economists have went off and looked at this in terms of energy demand and water demand and asked anyone if they could find their bill in the last 2 months or a year. And a lot of actually people came back and said they couldn't find their bill. But, you know, I believe that prices matter. You need to send a signal. People may not notice the difference between $20 or $25. They may not be able to tell you what the difference was. But I think if you opened your bill and you used more than 13,000 gallons of water per month, then you'd be getting a fairly large signal. Actually, it would be good to consume less water. Question from up here?
Does the new price apply to all the water that you use, or just the water you use beyond the 17 cubic feet?
Okay. The new price actually only applies to the water used beyond the threshold of 18 CCF. So, actually, just getting back, I hope I wasn't flip in answering your question, but I think it's you either believe prices matter or they don't, but I also believe that other conservation policies, how we measure them in terms of cost-benefit analysis, really compares to what the alternative is. The alternative is a lower price. Just one follow-up question.
Not a follow-up question, but a follow-up comment. I don't think your answer was flippant, but if you're going to argue that price influences water use, then people need to know that the price is different. If you go to the gas pump, you buy gasoline, you see the price written there. But if you ask me how much I pay for water, I have to tell you the truth, I don't have a clue.
Right.
Okay? So if those people don't know that there's a pricing structure built in, I mean, then how, you know, there's a connection there that I think you need to make. Establish your possible influence, which, I mean, you said that's one of the things you want to do.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I think a question back here.
In your research, did you look at zoning maps, lot sizes, particular neighborhoods, and more like that in your research?
So the question was, did I look at zoning maps in my research? So this is actually one point I didn't make in my presentation is that this is a fairly micro data. Based analysis. And the reason why I went to microdata is if you look at the literature, a lot of the literature uses fairly aggregated data. So you get all these kind of funny signs, like you have this positive sign correlation. So as the price goes up, people use more water. And that's because people aggregate the data together by census tract or by zip codes. So the reason why this data set is very powerful is because it's microdata based. But the second step that you're talking about is to actually look at the effects of certain neighborhoods on that kind of micro-level or individual-level consumption. And that's called multi-level modeling, which I'm basically engaged in right now. I think there's a question over here, sir.
Is there any differentiation on what the water uses are applying towards, such as is it all grass or lawns in these big yards, or are there small-scale agricultural things going on? Some of these
locks? That's actually an interesting question. The question was, do we actually know what this water is actually used for? And the short answer is no, we don't. I'm looking at data basically on the utility side of the meter. So we simply meter how much water goes through to these users. As far as I know, it's kind of hard to get data on individual users, what they use it for. I know there have been smaller field studies, and I think it's a really interesting area. I would say in the energy space, in terms of energy and electricity, you've probably heard a lot about smart meters and the smart grid recently. People will actually be able to estimate that in terms of what you actually use your energy for in your home. That technology, I think, has come to places like Australia, where water is very dear, and I can only say in the future I hope to get my hands on some of that data. And I think that's all the time we have for questions. If you have any questions, I'll be at the back. But thank you very much for your time.